Creasy versus GP Big Island, and GP Big Island versus Brandon Creasy, Mr. Feynman, and Mr. Pretty. I take it. We have scheduled this for a 40-minute argument. I think what I'd like to do, the issues are fairly distinct. I think I'd like to just hear this as two separate cases, if that's okay with you. Ms. Pretty, you have any objection to that? All right, well, we'll start with the Creasy versus Big Island, Mr. Feynman. And Mr. Pretty, I'm glad to see you're here today and not in perhaps Chesapeake. I understand you came a little early.
Yes, but it's a delightful drive.
Okay, Mr. Feynman, you want to begin? Do you want to reserve any? The other thing I wanted to mention is that, again, because we're in Lexington, we do not have any timing lights. I'll keep time from the bench, and I'll try to give you a heads up when you reach your rebuttal time. Ms. Feynman, you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. So the original time I'm allotted is?
It'll be two 15-minute arguments each, 30 minutes total. Rather than the 40
yes, sir.
We've scheduled.
I would like to at least reserve 5 minutes, but
that's fine.
It won't take that long to present my case in chief.
You may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, James B. Feynman on behalf of Mr. Creasy. I'm sure this court has read the briefs and the appendix thoroughly. The issues, as the court has observed, are distinct. The first issue is the permanent partial disability claim, which the deputy commissioner dismissed, and the divided full commission sustained that dismissal. We cite case after case after case in our brief and in the full commissioner Marshall at the appendix, page 392 through 394, cites case after case after case where the law has been for decades and decades and decades that if the claimant has not reached maximum medical improvement, the case is removed from the docket pending the determination of maximum medical improvement.
Well, is there a possibility of having an estoppel situation where counsel says, I want to go forward regardless, and so a ruling is made?
I could see that if the law for decades and decades and decades had said that. But when the law says the opposite, the cases, and we cite so many cases that where they say that's not the case, then to all of a sudden, in the middle of Mr. Creasy's case, change the rules leaves us completely.
But did you advise the commission that you wanted to go forward on the matter of permanent disability?
Well, the record was clear on that. She asked. I said, sure, we'll put it on. We submitted what I said, I believe, the exact words were, we submitted evidence on that. And again, as the cases that came before us time after time after time, when they did go forward and it was found that maximum medical improvement had not been reached, then it's removed from the hearing docket because, as the Supreme Court and this court has stated, that until maximum medical improvement is reached, there is no jurisdiction to hear that particular aspect of the claim.
Is the issue of maximum medical improvement before the commission, or was the issue whether you've established there was a permanent disability? Those are kind of distinct issues. Was the issue placed before the commission one of, is this MMI or is it not? Or was the issue, what is the permanent disability rating?
If I understand your question, it's part and parcel, because to have the jurisdiction to hear the permanent partial disability claim, there has to be a finding that the maximum medical improvement has been reached. When the deputy commissioner found that maximum medical improvement had not been reached, according to all the case law that has come before us, that's the end of it. And you remove it from the docket, you don't dismiss it, and there's just this case after case.
The cases you're referencing, let me ask you about those in a moment. Is that the language used in the case that it's a jurisdictional question? Doesn't have the power forward, or
I believe that's correct. I believe that's correct. They say that there's no jurisdiction to hear that. I believe that's correct.
I hadn't focused on that.
Yeah.
Your argument.
I believe that's correct. I cannot right now go to a case in a line and say so, but I believe that's correct.
But the commission would have to have jurisdiction to hear it in order to decide whether MMI had been reached.
I agree with that. But on that particular aspect of a claim, until maximum medical improvement has been reached, the case law says over and over and over again, it's not ripe for determination, and we remove it from the docket pending the achievement, if you will, of maximum medical improvement. Once that's reached, it's returned to the docket, and
When you say the case law, are you referring to the commission's case law or our case law?
Both. If you go to the appendix at page 392, there's the Montalbano versus Richmond Ford case, 57 Virginia Appellate 235. There's the Supreme Court case of Spotsylvania, County of Spotsylvania versus Hart, 218 Virginia. The Commission's case, Lofton Ridge versus Norfolk Southern Railroad.
Now, do these cases hold that you have to reach maximum medical improvement before a determination is made as to permanent disability, or do they hold that the Commission is obligated to defer the claim and that collateral estoppel does not apply?
Both.
Which page on the joint appendix were you reading from again?
It's page 392 through 394.
Yes, sir.
Is the Commissioner Marshall's dissent, which collects a vast number of cases that are in opposition to this, and then also in our brief, I didn't find any that he didn't find, but I did highlight those that say that. The one case that they rely on, Olmos versus Fast Fabricators, is not applicable because in that case the party stipulated that the claimant had reached MMI. It wasn't an MMI issue. They stipulated that there was MMI, and the question was the treating physician had not found any permanency. A non-treating physician gave the claimant a 50% rating to the leg. The injury had been to the great toe. The deputy commissioner found there was impairment to the great toe, but didn't have a rating for the great toe, so no award was issued. And the commission said, in that circumstance, it was res judicata. But that was a case where MMI had been stipulated to. Here, there was a specific finding that there was no MMI. That's on the... I can't say anything more about it except the rules were changed in the middle of the game. And then I have the one other issue where the exact same thing happened. And we try these cases, two or three of these cases a week, and I've never seen the law change in the middle of a case like this. On the marketing issue, the commission's guidelines, I'm sure you're familiar with this from having read the briefs, that my client went in 54 days when he was out of work. He went to 46 different employers and applied for work, wrote down the name of who he applied, and they held that was unreasonable marketing. And the only grounds they had for saying that was not reasonable marketing was because he had not pre-screened these employers to find out whether or not they had jobs available. But the commission's own guidelines say you do not have to pre-screen your employers to find out if they're hiring. So when we, as lawyers, read the guidelines and counsel our clients, we don't tell them that they have to pre-screen to find out if these employers are hiring, because the commission's guidelines say we don't have to tell them that. So then we come up there and I don't even know where the evidence is in the record that says that he didn't do that. It's just, again, it's changing the rules in the middle of the game and contrary to the specific written holdings that we have, guided ourselves by. I've only been practicing 31 years, but these have been the rules. And today, we're presented with situations where they changed them on two counts in the middle of the case, and it cost my client a lot of money.
Is that a factual finding, whether there was adequate marketing?
Well, that in a sense it is, but when it's also a legal finding, because when the commission's own guidelines say
we're not bound by the commission's guidelines.
I, I agree. I mean, the guidelines.
If it's a legal issue, then we address it as such. If it's a factual issue, our only query is whether there was evidence to support that factual finding.
I agree with that analysis. I think it's a mixed question of law and of fact. When first of all, when you go 46 times to employers in 54 days, there is no evidence to sustain that that's the unreasonable marketing. The only evidence that they had was this claim that he didn't pre-screen these employers to find out if they were indeed offering light duty work. That was the only finding. So first of all, how you can tell that by looking at the claimant's marketing list, I don't know. I think that's pure speculation. You can't look at that marketing list and say, oh, he didn't pre-screen. What they said was, it appears that he didn't. And I don't think that that's a factual evidence in a record that can support that. But the question of law is that their finding was, you have to pre-screen. And the failure to pre-screen to find out if light duty is being offered means you lose, when their own rules have said that it doesn't mean that.
The language you're looking at is the claimant failed to target potential employers who were hiring. Is that your basis for saying that they require pre-screening?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah, you're reading from the deputy commissioner.
Much less who had openings with his restricted. The claimant failed to target potential employers who were hiring, much less who had openings within his restrictions.
Correct. That's the only quote-unquote blip.
Looking at the guideline that says it is not necessary to pre-screen or know for certain of the availability of a suitable job.
Absolutely. That's I've laid my finger on the error. Your Honor has read it.
Okay. Okay. Mr.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah, you're into your rebuttal now, so it could be a good time.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Pretty?